The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest-growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
We are live from the East Coast of the United States. You are listening to Breaking Banks, the first and only truly global podcast in the world. It's where it all started, folks. I'm your host, Brett King, and I'm back in New York City after a few days in Miami, which was great. Caught up with Sam Moll down there. We did some planning for the show. And, of course, you guys know Sam has got FinTech 5 podcast now. So I was able to finally do an interview on FinTech 5. So check that out when it comes out. If you haven't caught up with Sam's new podcast, FinTech 5, definitely check it out. We were in Miami, though, for the Temenos Innovation Jam. And we were focused on Latin American startups or startups that sort of have scope into LATAM. And also this week we had our good friend Dave Birch, a regular on the show. He was at the Temenos Innovation Jam in London and did a great job there by all reports. We had some of the fintech mafia at the event, and they gave it the thumbs up. Like my producer Rachel, I think Dave is one of the bravest men in fintech. You know, his speech that he gave at the Temenos Innovation Jam was about Internet of Things and how, you know, what your underpants might tell people about you. So you know, what do your underwear tell you? You know, when your underwear is connected to the internet, what does that say about your behavior? Only Dave Birch could get away with talking about underwear when you connect it with fintech. We also had a two-day conference in New York with Findeva that just happened. It was great. Our team was there as well. And, you know, Findeva prepping for their London conference on June 12th and 13th. And also don't forget Finovate Spring is coming up in May in Silicon Valley as well. So that leads us to the conference announcement. And now, actually, no, Finovate Spring is April 26 and 27 at the San Jose Convention Center in lovely San Jose. And you can register, of course, using the Breaking Banks 20 code to get a 20% discount. And you'll find that information on our conference page as well. Don't forget also on the 10th and the 11th, I will be in London at the Innovate Finance Summit in London. That's their global summit, April 10th and 11th. I'll be speaking there and helping out with a demo day for their Pitch 360 competition at Guildhall. And then BAI is having their Innovation Global Awards again. So applications are due April 28th. Make sure you get them in. And we're also pleased to announce, drum roll, that we will be the podcast partner, exclusive podcast partner for Money 2020 Europe. And FinTech 5 and Breaking Banks will both be there. We'll be interviewing all the keynote speakers on FinTech 5. We'll be doing the show run-up that week on the Breaking Banks show. So you're going to hear all about Money 2020 from there. So you can find all about these conferences on our Breaking Banks website, breakingbanks.com. They'll be there with the discount codes. And, go ahead. Because of your Breaking Banks relationship, we're giving you that value. We're giving you a discount. Aren't we so nice to you guys? All right. Mary Wazinski is joining us from America Banker Wiznis. Sorry, Mary.
I'll do it.
Yeah, you do it.
Fred,
you do
it's Wisniewski, or that's an American
Wisniewski.
Way.
Okay, good. So so thanks for joining us today. I know Mark and Penny are out doing lots of goodness today. So, did you see this news on Tandem in the UK? So Tandem Bank, I don't know whether you saw it, but, you know, they've raised £28 million to date. That was including a $6 million investment from House of Fraser. They also did a $1 million crowdfunding contribution. And they they had planned another $29 million in cash injection to beef up their, you know, essentially their business for the regulatory component. And SandPower, who's a Chinese-led conglomerate, which owns House of Fraser, is already invested in them. These guys pulled out at the 11th hour. $29 million is pretty difficult to find in today's market. So it'll be interesting to see how that pans out. Have you been watching news on the OCC FinTech Charter here, Mary? Have we got anybody putting up their hand to say they're going to go through that process? Are you aware of that? Or,
well, I don't know if anyone's publicly raising their hand, but certainly interest is there. You know, it's I feel like it's still a lot of unknowns, and entrepreneurs, you know, see potential. They also see kind of like a lot of rigmarole to go through. And of course, you know, it's still being debated in the U.S.
Yeah. So, you know, we see, look, there's still a lot of deals to be done. What's really interesting is, you know, I've seen two reports come out this week. One that says 2016 was the biggest year ever for fintech investments, and another report that said there was a 6% decline in fintech investments. So I don't know, maybe that just comes down to how that they measure the investment, but it does seem like investments are leveling off. What is happening is deals in Asia. There's record number of fintech deals in Asia. Now, this shouldn't be a surprise. Asia tends to lag, you know, investment in these sort of trends. We saw it with the .com. You know, we see it with other trends, you know, with the markets generally follow. So the fact that Asia suddenly come awake with fintech investment, I don't think is a huge surprise. But in 2015, there was 55 fintech deals in Asia. 2016 saw that climbed to 71 deals. That's a 30% increase. So if you're in Asia right now starting a fintech, that should be good news for you guys. There's stuff happening down there. But Mary, I did notice you did a very interesting story, and it's been in the New York Times as well, on how data aggregation is sort of coming to the fore. It wasn't that long ago that JP Morgan Chase led an effort to say that they were going to cut access to aggregation services and stop people from getting access to their own data or feeding Chase's data in. There's a big backlash against that. But so where are we ending up with this sort of, you know, data aggregation in terms of the way it plays into lending decisions and so forth now?
Well, this has been like one of those storylines that's really like capturing my heart, because there's so much drama. And basically, to rewind a little bit, CFPB put this into spotlight a few months back, and there's this big debate of who owns the data, and they did a request of comments recently. So it's this huge debate of you know, what are the liabilities if something goes wrong with using aggregation, and of course we're talking about screen scraping here too. And meanwhile, as you mentioned, like companies are trying to use aggregation to quicken underwriting decisions, including mortgages. So it's one of the biggest, most important debates, I think, going on right now in fintech.
Now, you know, are we going to have to deal with the way we capture data and use data in decision making? Because that's what it's all going to be about. I mean, we've got these machine learning algorithms. We're deploying sensors all over the place. We're tracking your behavior and data on a smartphone. You know, there's a lot of talk about civil liberties and, you know, who should have access to your data. But do you think there's sort of a generational shift here? Do you think that millennials just expect that their data is going to be not public property, but more accessible, and there's a value exchange there, and that the baby boomers are still thinking about, you know, people getting access to their identity and stealing their identity?
Yeah, I mean, I do see that divide, even among my friends who happen to be a lot of millennials, you know. But the, you know,
you're so cool. You got millennial friends.
Look at me, Brett. I'm rolling with today's youth. But like, no, people, they would be surprised if paper was involved, you know. Younger people don't expect these laborious to-dos. You expect your data quickly. But on the flip side, to defend bank's stance, I don't think it's so like evil doing to be like, I'm blocking this, you know, screen scraping. It's more like they have concerns around security and consumers sharing their credentials. And I don't think younger people really think about what sharing bank credentials does to like be able to use something like Venmo.
Yeah. Yeah, talking about that, I don't know, did you see the news that Fiserv has now announced a competitor for taking on Stripe and Douala? It's an SDK for payments.
Yeah, I just saw, I mean, I saw the headline. Very interesting.
Yeah, you know, everyone's sort of thinking about this payment space right now in terms of where that's where this is going to go. But in terms of the data play, you know, how do you think data is, what sort of data that could we bring to bear in terms of lending decisions that, you know, that differ from the traditional credit scoring approach?
Well, you know, this is tied to a story I recently did too. I mean, the transaction data, you know, what online lenders are already crunching into their models to lend, that's, you know, just one part. Of course, people are looking at social data, et cetera. But the transaction data, and that's the bit you get if you do aggregation, you know, people think you can extend credit to a wider audience that, you know, is not that risky.
Yeah. You know, I did remember a data point being talked about for Lending Club where they said that actually in terms of predicting default, that whether you pay your phone bill on time was a much more accurate predictor of default than your credit score.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I've heard that as well.
I guess it must be true. Did you read it on the internet?
I read it on the internet, Brett.
There you go. So it's got to be true.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So, yeah, you know, but that sort of makes sense. But, you know, it sort of shows us how we're going to have to change the way we think about lending decisions, because if it turns out that the credit score actually isn't a very good predictor of someone's ability to pay a loan back and a more aggregated view of data does that better, then everybody's going to want that data because it's going to reduce risk. So then it comes down to why would someone give you data? What's sort of the view of that, do you think, in terms of the broader market?
Well, I mean, I think it just raises a lot of questions. You know, I think it was Penny who recently did a story that was speaking to the risk of online lenders targeting, you know, adults attending Ivy League schools, you know, and how that might be unfair. So I don't know. I just think we're at this point. It's very fascinating, you know, extending credit to a wider audience. I mean, that is such an important thing. So many people need access to credit. And yet there's so many questions to figure out just to make sure you're not messing it up.
Absolutely. Well, let's invite someone else onto the show right now, Mary, and stay with us. And I'd love to have you jump in and give your comments on this as well. As part of what's sort of happening in the ecosystem, globally, we see a big push towards real-time payments, faster payments. It's called here in the US, the official strategy for the Fed in terms of enabling this. In the EU, we've seen a shift towards this gradually over the last a decade or so, first with Gyro and then with SEPA. And now we see even things like PSD2, which is sort of enabling access to open data and aggregation. They seem quite advanced in this respect. But here in the US, things move a bit slower because we've got to get consensus across all of the states. But having said that, if you look at the two fastest growing businesses in financial services globally today, you would maybe look at organizations like Stripe and so forth. But the big dark horse here is, of course, Alipay and WeChat. You know, these guys are everywhere right now. You got WeChat, you know, coming into Africa in a dominant way. Alipay has acquired interest in Paytm, Kakao in Korea, GCash in the Philippines, Paytm in India. They bought MoneyGram here in the United States. I mean, when you're looking at mobile-based real-time payments networks, there's a lot of competition that doesn't fall into the realm of, you know, an ACH or bank-to-bank payment network or payment rails that are necessarily run by incumbents. So we wanted to get someone in to talk about this. We're inviting the CEO and founder of Push Payments, Travis Delaney, to join us right now. Travis, welcome to the show.
Hello, Brett. How are you doing? Long time no see.
Good. Yeah, it's been a while, dude. It's been a while indeed. So tell me, what is you're the CEO and founder of Push Payments. What does Push Payments do, first of all? Let's get that out of the way.
So Push Payments is a payment processor, basically, that And in essence, we help companies reduce their cost and increase revenues, but we're really a industry a play. So we're an API organization that allows the rest of the industry to take advantage of what we've worked for 5 years to build, so that you don't have to recreate the model. So for processors and other industry players that want to empower instant payments and real-time payments for their customers.
Now, I've got a thesis on this, right? The reason, you know, we talk a lot about real-time payments or instant payments, as you've characterized it, from a structural perspective. But I think that, you know, in terms of consumers, consumers think of a payment like an SMS, right? That, you know, if I'm sending you $50 via my phone, I should be able to just pick up my phone and go, here's $50, and ba-bing, you know, you get a message on your phone going, you've received $50. It shouldn't really be more complicated than that. You know, is that a fair enough characterization of how consumers think about payments and how they should work?
You're absolutely correct. You know, we see commercials today where everybody's sitting at a dinner table, the check comes, somebody says, I got it, and everybody pulls out their phone and says, I'll send you $10, I'll send you $10, right? So the idea of instant real-time payments already exists in most people's minds. They don't think right. about it. And let's face it, payments is not a thought that most people think about or want to think about.
Unless you don't get the money you're expecting. You know, when you don't get the money you're expecting, you suddenly get very nervous. Like, where's my money?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so what's happened really, if you think about over the last 5 to 7 years, is we've worked very hard to create user experiences. And we've worked very hard to reduce friction for the consumer, for the marketplace, to help people, you know, go through their daily lives, right? And you know, you were talking earlier, Mary, about the millennials, and that you know, that's what they want, right? It's that user experience, that easy. Don't make it hard. I don't want to learn anything. I want to just make it easy for me. You know, everything from walking into the grocery store and already knowing what you need to spend and what your budgets are. You know, that's the AI of the world, right? So that's the user experience side. The sad part is the infrastructure, the rails, the legacy systems that we have in the U.S. today is 40 years old. And right, so it's right. not so much the state separations and the governmental regulatory
the
items. It's really this old iron, the big right. iron that's out there is not easy to move. It's like changing your entire infrastructure in a city. What do? You lift up the city and rip it out and put it back in?
You know, I wish you could have been a fly on the wall. You know, it was last year I was invited to the White House to meet with the National Economic Council to talk with them about the future of banking. And I made a claim in that meeting that we had in the West Wing that you should have seen the reaction, because I said to them, you guys really need to look at an advanced payments economy as a model for what you're doing here in the U.S. And there's some really great examples of that out there. And they're like, oh, so what is that? Is that Europe? Is it Singapore? Is it Australia? And I said, well, no, you really want to go to an economy where today they have instant payments mobile to mobile for 90% of the population. And they're like, where's that? And I was like, well, Kenya, of course. You know, and the reaction was priceless to suggest that Kenya might have a more advanced payments ecosystem than the US. But, you know, in respect to where the US is in this cycle, you know, you've said the US is behind because of this legacy. I mean, how serious is this? How far behind is the US with some of these other markets?
Well, you know, I'd say that we're really trailing. I mean, the long story, the long short of this is that Europe, Australia, and Asia, all these countries are far ahead of us in a number of ways. And you bring up the RuPay example, and it's because there is no infrastructure, there's no other way, and it was right. It was simple. So India is in that spot today. There's a huge amount of growth going on in India simply because there is no infrastructure. And there's a paradigm shift about using banks. So
right. Well, and they also just demonetized. they demonetized and forced people to use mobile payments. So right. Yeah, that's a good reason why there's an 800% increase in the last 4 months, right?
Oh, absolutely, right. And this is a country that is just now starting with ATM networks and stuff. So there's a lot of growth in these other countries because of the digitalization of their payment and their financial services arena. So really, this is one situation where our maturity is actually our biggest Achilles heel.
Yeah. No, I mean, look, I talk about this, and you know, Mary, maybe you can jump in as well. But you know, one of the problems you have in the U.S. is, like, you know, simple things. Like, if you live in New York and you have a landlord in New York, you know, you're going to have a large percentage of private landlords in New York that are going to want to receive their rental payment on a check, right? And then you have millennials who will walk into a bank today to open a bank account, and the first thing they'll be offered is a checking account, and they'll walk out because they don't want to use checks. They don't see themselves as using checks. So this is a really, you know, you've got some legacy behavior, but, you know, if you look at Venmo adoption within millennials, you know, it's clear that these younger you know, players in this ecosystem are trying to find workarounds to that. But do we need a consensus here in the U.S. to fix this problem?
That's an excellent question. I don't know that consensus is the right word for it, but we need a general acceptance, right? So, and I guess this is a good time to bring up the fact that, you know, the Federal Reserve put together the Faster Payments Task Force and the Secure Payment Task Force, largely because, you know, they really had done a study back in 2013, I believe it was, where they were assessing what, you know, how can we improve the system. And they came back with a lot of themes, and some of that was security. Some of that was obviously speed. And there's a number of other criterias. And so they formed a task force, and in so many words, they basically said, they put out an open invitation to anybody in the industry to come join the task force and help us figure it out, right? And the Fed was very careful not to mingle, if you will, or interject where they didn't feel it was necessary. You know, I kind of joke around sometimes that it almost felt like it was a big networking event sponsored by the Fed. But, you know, it actually worked, you know, and there's a lot of things that's come out of that. This is started as a 332-person member organization. It's grown to well over 440 or 450, I think, now. And it's made up of not just industry people. You know, these are payments executives. These are banks. We're broken into segments, if you will. You know, so they've got small, medium, large banks. You've got consumer advocates. You've got, you know, just everyday users. You know, anybody can join the task force and have input or insight to what's going on. So it's really helped a lot to, A, help everybody understand. Because in the payment arena, a lot of people think of payments, and all they think of is retail payments. Right. And it's a lot more than that. As you noted, ACH is a large component of funds movement, and it's just kind of behind the scenes, you know, whether it be paying a payroll check to somebody or whether it be business to business, and it's used in different ways. You mentioned Dowalla earlier. You know, Dowalla is a company that took the idea of ACH and turned it into, you know, a business in itself to make it an API front for that, you know, which was was brilliant and is time for Ben. And so, you know, this allows really for all of us to get together as an industry to see what's wrong and where we can fix it. And there's been a lot of progress, a huge amount of progress. There is a website that anybody can go to, and I think it's Fed Payments. Improvement.org, and you know, you can look up what's going on with that and what's public knowledge, so to speak. There's an effectiveness criteria that's been outlined a couple of years ago that we're going to stay within, and those categories are really kind of simple, but they're important. You know, so there's speed, security, efficiency, international was an issue, and collaboration. So words like interoperability and ubiquity and things like that come into play.
So let me come back to push payments for a minute. You know, you guys have an API. Are you a closed loop system? Do you sit on top of ACH? You know, what are the rails that you use for, these instant payments?
So I am glad you asked that. You know, so we the rails. You know, that's starting to become a word that I'm not sure it has the same meaning it used to. But we're really connected to all the networks in the U.S. and a number of them internationally. So we can ride over networks that are, you know, ACH. We can ride over, which is really not a rail, by the way. It's just a process. And we also ride over the card networks. So we really route the transaction appropriately. There are closed-loop networks that are in our venue that we can route to. But we're not a closed-loop overall. So we're really connected to all these as a hub and spoke kind of scenario. So right. We look kind of like a gateway. But we can basically reach every DDA in the U.S. in under 2 seconds by moving funds.
Great. Fantastic. So, we are looking at solutions like yours. You've mentioned, we've both mentioned Dwolla. We've got Stripe, we've got Venmo. There are already real-time payments ecosystems available in the United States. And if you look broader afield, you've got, you know, Alipay, WeChat, and, other networks emerging that are becoming sort of global networks. Facebook potentially get in the cross-border payments game. Google's doing some in that space. There's a lot of stuff happening that are technology-based rails and not government or regulation-based rails. Do these two worlds collide in the future? Do they remain separate? Can a consensus-led Fed system be as efficient as a Venmo or Dwolla?
You know, I couldn't almost paid you to ask you a better question. So, that is actually an excellent point. And I think that the real answer is that at one point they will all come together. You're right. The technology play the virtual aspect of closed loop and can become interoperable. And so, and that's really part of what we look to do is help those fintechs and help those companies that live in that world be able to move those funds appropriately to their bank accounts if necessary, right? You know, there is, discussions for some where, maybe there's never an old bank regulated model in the future. You know, so I look at it as that we're that connector from the legacy world to yep. the virtual world and back and forth. So we can create those virtual experiences for a mobile wallet or a mobile play or interconnect. Look at an option where you got an EFT network that is actually virtual between neobanks. There's all kinds of options as it relates to that. And what I see is that they're all going to kind of interconnect. And, you mentioned Alipay earlier. I wouldn't be surprised if that's exactly what he's looking to do.
He said he's looking to do that. 3 billion people he wants on the network by 2020.
Yeah. So if you think about all his users, e-commerce, and then you take MoneyGram, well, MoneyGram brings financial inclusion into that. It's almost like a loading source, right? So, one of the things we work with a network that allows for something that like that similar where, you can walk into a CVS or Walgreens and basically move money, to other individuals that are in the, ecosystem, even though they might be unbanked. So, that's that same kind of concept. So Alipay, I think, is, looking to bridge that legacy with the virtual and create their own virtual world that lives there.
No, absolutely. I just saw a report. It's good news for you guys. ITA Group released a report this week that said the digital P2P market in the U.S. is going to grow to estimated $318 billion by 2020. But get this. This year, it's expected China will do $3 trillion in mobile payments. So yeah, we got a way to go. And listen, we're gonna take it to break, Travis. So how do people find out more about what you guys are doing over at Instant Payments?
Just go to pushpayments.com and easily sign up or submit for a meeting or for a demo. We can demo the platform and go from there.
And how long before you think there is going to be real-time bank-to-bank payments in the U.S.? Give me a year. When are we going to have that?
So once everything that we've got outlined in our task force and stuff materializes, you know, the dates are being thrown around that we'd like to see is around 2020, where you've actually got, you know, real-time kind of settlement at a Fed level. But, you know, we're facilitating bank-to-bank payments now. I think that we're probably one of very, very few, if not the only one that's out there doing it today.
Yep. And great. Well, thanks for joining us, Travis. We hope to have, you know, if you got some more news on the faster payment stuff that's happening, let us know. We'll get you back on the show.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Brett.
All right, we're going to go to a break right now, but before that, we're going to be back in about a minute with our next guest, Rachel Schneider, who is releasing her new book, The Financial Diaries, based on a study of the same name. So we'll be right back from this quick break and word from our sponsors.
Follow us on Twitter at VoiceAmericaTRN. Get the lowdown on guests, new shows, and your favorites. That's VoiceAmericaTRN.
What do financial services of the future look like? Invisible yet ubiquitous, blended into our lives like air, gravity. This podcast. Temenos has specialized for 20 years in creating the best financial technology for thousands of financial institutions worldwide. Our open fintech marketplace allows millions of people to experience money in exciting new ways. Join the most vibrant financial services ecosystem in the world. Temenos, we make the money go round.
We're always talking business.
Talk to an expert.
Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag #BreakingBanks. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back. I'm Brett King, your host for Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech podcast and the first global fintech podcast. Okay, so we are here now with Rachel Schneider, SVP. I guess that stands for Senior Vice President, does it, Rachel?
It does, yep.
But it's not Special Vice President.
Or... No, I'm glad to say it's not.
You're with the Center for Financial Services Innovation. Now, we've had CFSI on the show a few times, but just for those that aren't familiar with CFSI, what does CFSI do?
Well, I'm glad you asked. So we're a nonprofit. Our goal is to improve the financial health of Americans. But the way we do that, the way we think about that is that better financial services, better practices within the business place all impact financial health. And so we do everything we can to help nudge business practices in the direction of good for consumers. And we lead a large network of over 120 entities now, everyone from you know, the smallest fintech to the largest banks in the country. And the purpose of that network is to give the participants in the network the tools and information that they need to be able to make their products and services advance the financial health of Americans.
Mm, yeah. Now, you've just written this book, The Financial Diaries, How American Families Cope in a World of Uncertainty. But America's not the only place with financial uncertainty, is it? So is there lessons here for people outside of the U.S. as well?
Oh, there absolutely are. And, you know, this research actually came out of some research that was done in the developing world. So a number of years ago now, there was this idea of doing financial diaries, and financial diaries were collected in South Africa and Bangladesh and India. And my co-author in this work, Jonathan Mordock, helped to co-author a book about those international diaries called Portfolios of the Poor. And what was interesting was, you know, in the U.S. we collect, and in much of the developed world, we collect just reams and reams and reams of financial data, right? We know lots of details about people's financial lives. And yet this international work that had a completely different methodology, which was instead of to do a one-time snapshot or to do focus groups, was to work with a small number of families over a period of time and understand their financial lives over a period of time, generated insights that felt new and different and that you couldn't really replicate without that research methodology. And so a consortium of people led by the Citi Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Omidyar Network, NYU, CFSI, and BFA originally, who had done some of that international work, decided we should replicate that in the U.S. But it's interesting because a lot of what you learn is globally applicable, right? People struggle with the same kinds of issues financially around the world.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, what sort of breakdown in terms of the data that you the families or people that you got involved in documenting their financial diaries, can you give us sort of a breakdown of what sort of people that included?
Sure. So what we did is we had field researchers in 10 different locations in the U.S., and they each worked with 20 to 30 families. And what they did is a little bit insane. They went and met with the households every few weeks, and we tried to gather data about absolutely everything the household did, borrowed, spent, saved, earned, gave away. And what we did is the households, the one criterion was that every family we worked with had to have at least one working person. But other than that, what we were trying to do was give a diverse picture of the American experience. So about a quarter of the research participants were around the area median income for where they live, so roughly middle class. About a quarter were near the poverty line, and the other half was in between. And in some places we were working with immigrant communities, in some places communities that had been in the U.S. for generations, you know, every ethnicity, families with kids, families without kids, every age, right? So it's really a kind of attempt to show what financial life is like in America today from a lot of different perspectives.
Hey, Rachel, it's Mary here from American mm-hmm. Banker. Let's talk about, I mean, I'm curious, you know, is this income, is this volatility, is it a poor thing? Or, you know, are we talking, you know, is it across demographics?
Yeah, you know, you're referencing the fact that one of our key findings was that incomes are extremely volatile. And so what we found was that on average, you know, so we were collecting data over the course of the year, and we looked at what is the monthly income of each family. And then we discovered that in 5 months out of the year, income was 25% more or less than that average, right? So there's this huge volatility that people experience. What's amazing about research like this is we shared that early finding a few years ago, and it inspired other people to start looking at national data sets to find out if that was true. If you looked at a bigger group of people, is it true if you look at different income ranges, you know, to get to your question? And certainly lower and moderate income people have more volatility than the middle class, but volatility goes pretty high up the income spectrum. The Federal Reserve and has looked at this. The FDIC started asking some questions about it. And it's all validating the idea that income volatility is a real challenge for many, many people.
So tell us some of the stories that you found out. What, as you were going through the research, where did you have your aha moments in the book that is like, wow, you know?
That's such a good question. There were so many, and you know, I was really glad to be part of like the content you've already been talking about on today's podcast is so in line with some of the kinds of ahas that we had during the research. So, you know, I'm thinking about one family that is the story we opened the book with, a couple named Becky and Jeremy, and they live in Ohio, and Jeremy works fixing long haul trucks. So he's exactly this worker we are imagining who has a lot of volatility, but it's not because he doesn't work full time, right? His job is a full time job, but he gets paid on commission. And so in the summer, when the weather is bad, you know, asphalt's hot, truck tires blow out, there's a lot of work for him. In the winter, same deal for other reasons that, you know, somebody who understands trucks better than me is better at explaining. In the spring and the fall, their income is much lower. And so what Becky does is, you know, she stockpiles canned goods. She fills her freezer completely. She has, you know, a pantry full of toothpaste. Because when they're flush, like when he's earning more, if she can find a deal, she stocks up. And she does that because it's just so much easier to save by putting a bunch of things she knows she'll need eventually aside than it is to save using a savings account. And, you know, over and over we heard these stories about the kinds of workarounds people came up with to be able to make their financial life work. And a lot of times these workarounds reflect like some gap in our financial services. So for her, right, there's something about a savings account that didn't give her the kind of discipline that she knew she needed. She said it's just way too easy to spend the money.
And so she saved by buying consumables that she was going to use later effectively.
Exactly, exactly. And a lot of times we heard stories that really make it clear how much people need real-time payments, right? So stories around exactly when you're going to pay your bill relative to when you're going to get paid, right? So Becky is one of the many, many people in the study who describes sort of a constant real-time budgeting process. There's right, one yeah. family, one woman we've got to know who has a spreadsheet she keeps of that she does a budget at the beginning of the year where she budgets for absolutely everything she's going to spend, literally. You know, she's got a column per month and then a row for each thing she might buy. And she checks it daily.
Wow.
And, you know, in that context, like the idea that you wouldn't have real-time payments and you wouldn't have the real-time information about your balances that come with real-time payments, sort of mind-boggling. Like you really get a visceral image of why that might matter.
This sort of gives you a different perspective on sort of the gigging economy, because, you know, if you get an unexpected bill come through, then you might say, well, I've got to go out and drive for Uber for 5 hours, or let's rent out the spare room for a week. But you're going to want that money to come in near real time so that you can, tackle the unexpected expenses that you might have that come up. So, you know, we have to spend in real time. So maybe there's this push to earn in real time as well.
I think so. I think it's not an accident that Uber and Lyft have both had to figure out how to pay their drivers fast. And I don't know if, I think they are real. They're not quite real time, but they're same day or next day.
They're getting close.
Right?
Yeah.
They're really close.
Yeah. In fact, I know payroll companies right now working on that, where you can opt in to get paid early. Sort of dynamic credit arrangements, but not payday lending, but, you know, as part of the payroll mechanism that your company sets up, you could get paid earlier.
It's true. And there's a handful of startups that are trying to facilitate the same, right? There's flex wage and there's active hours. And I think those ideas, like there's real legs there. People want access to their money faster. I think the financial health challenge you want to think about then is, does it end up being a constructive choice, right? So if you think about Becky, like she wants some help creating discipline. She wants some help not getting her money. And at the same time, she needs access. So what we really find that people need is some balance between, you know, structured ways to save and put money aside for the future versus flexibility, because sometimes you actually just do need the cash now and you just do.
So it sounds like, you know, that the average American or the average person, because it's not just limited to America, but this concept that people will be able to budget and plan and so forth, I think we sort of have to put that to bear, that there's very small percentage of the population who actually are planned in terms of this. And it tends to be a lot messier.
Definitely. And, you know, I hear, like, as you and Mary were talking at the top of the hour about how data and machine learning and tracking our behavior on smartphones was affecting everything, I was thinking, you know, there's a real application here. Like, I think the level of complexity that people are managing for themselves about their own financial lives screams for help and advice. But that help and advice has to be personalized. It has to be specific. It has to be actionable in the moment. But as we get so much better at data analytics, and as we get better at making use of the massive amount of data that's being generated, I think you're going to see that happen.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I know you're familiar with this Neil Gabler essay that he had in The Atlantic last May, which was The Secret Shame of the Middle Class, because you responded to that. But he talks about it didn't surprise him that many Americans couldn't even come up with $400 in the case of an emergency. And even though he's a relatively successful writer, he said he would be included in that group. Now, you talk in the book about informal lending as a mechanism to sort of deal with emergencies. So what is that?
Yeah, I have to give a shout out to the Federal Reserve. This is a moment, you know, they published this research that said that only 47% of Americans could easily come up with $400. And that data point, like, I've heard it repeated back so many times, has really informed how people think about financial gaps. And that was a really powerful article that Neil Gabler wrote about how that played out in his life. It is the case that a lot of how people manage those kinds of surprise expenses, or not even necessarily surprises, but the expenses that are too big for them to be able to handle with cash on hand, is borrowing from friends and family. So within the diary sample, 95% of the sample at some point during the year had some financial transaction with a neighbor, a relative, friend, right? 95%. So basically, you know, everyone was in relationship with other people with their money. And a lot of times that's giving money or sharing resources or receiving a gift. But a significant percentage of the time, it's in the form of loans, and usually loans without interest, but just an expectation that, like, I'll help you when you need help, you'll help me when I need help, and that kind of informal sharing and borrowing is really critical to how really an extraordinary number of families make ends meet.
Yeah. Now, just before we sort of continue a bit more about the book and the research and what you came up with, let me ask you about your process of writing, because I'm always interested as an author myself. I like to hear from other authors about where do they write, what time of day do you write, you know, what do you find most effective as your environment for writing a book?
Oh, I'm just smiling as you ask that question. I thought about this so much, and I also ask writers this question all the time because I found it really hard. And you, like me, like, you've written while you have a day job, right? So I found that to be really hard, like, because it's a completely different side of your brain to, like, show up and write a chapter than it is to show up and do, you know, a day's worth of conference calls.
Absolutely. When do you have a specific time of day you write at, or do you have a specific place where you write?
No, but I tried not to get complete, you know, focused on. I ended up, just because of the way my life works, needing to write in a bunch of different places. I did join a place in New York called the Writer's Room, which is basically like an empty room, you know, with a bunch of carols and silence, and, you know, for. And that was invaluable because I found it really hard to write, like, in my office where we're in, you know, shared space. And it was really useful to feel like I write at a different desk than I do calls and emails at. So I spent a lot of time there. I also, you know, I have a co-author, so it couldn't always be around, like, when I was available. A lot of the project for us
You left it all to your co-author?
To work together.
That's
fine. I missed that.
No, I was just saying, so you left it all to the co-author.
Yeah, exactly. If only. No, not quite. But there was a lot of give and take, a lot of back and forth and editing. And I often write wearing, you know, headphones with white noise to sort of drown out everything else and create a sense to focus that way.
Yeah, So I write at coffee shops for the same reason. I find the white noise at coffee shops is much better for me than sitting at home when it's quiet. I can't write at home when it's quiet. I don't know, and music distracts me, so I need the white noise. So maybe I'll have to try that with the headphones. It might work.
Well, you know, there's this app called Coffeetivity, and that's actually what I listen to, and it just has a lot of different versions of coffee shop noise.
Yeah.
So you and I are not alone there. Coffee shops work.
No, absolutely. So, Mary, you had a question about how the process of writing this book. You want to jump in there?
Yeah, I do. So, you know, not only like the practicalities of how you write a book, but I'm curious if you found it's influencing the way you manage your own money, hearing these other people's stories.
You know, that's a great question. We know that the work influenced the way the people we worked with managed money, right? So these 235 families, the research goal was that we shouldn't influence their money because we're trying to understand how they manage their money. But in fact, you know, you can't sit down with somebody regularly and talk about their money and not have it change a little bit. And so we did hear that from a lot of the participants and from the field researchers who did the work. I think that for me, I don't know. One of the ahas for me that really I think stems from the research is, you know, from hearing how families do it, is more about how emotional money is. So I don't know that my behavior has changed, but the fact is that our choices about money, about how to spend, how to earn, they're not black and white math kind of choices. We want them to be. Like when we think about personal finance advice, we want people to be able to make those choices based on the math. But the reality is that we all have a lot of emotions tied up in our financial lives and in the choices we make. And that became really clear to me writing this. And I became more aware of that in my own life too.
Now you found people did save, but it tended to be short term, short lived. Do you want to talk a bit more about that? Is that sort of like, is that emergency funds, or is it more just this month I've got a bit extra and I'll put it in the bank?
You know, it's the idea is that, and we did see this, that people are saving for the long term. So, 80% of the savings that we tracked, people said, that's money I expect to spend in the next 3 months. And what's going on there is that people, you know, don't have, right, if you think about this combination of they don't have $400 saved necessarily, so they don't have a cushion. They have ups and downs in their income. They have ups and downs in their earnings. In their spending, because we all do, right? Christmas, school, car repairs, but also some months your utility bill is just higher than other months. So people are managing a lot in the near term, and so we tend to think about savings as something you're going to do for the long term, for big, far away goals. And so when we think about how to help people save and design products that help people save, we tend to think about it as this, as how we get people not to spend too much today so they can save for the future. But the reality is that people are constantly choosing to save, but they're choosing to save for the near term. They're worried about soon. And so it's not as simple as this binary, don't spend, save for your future. Because people are saving. It's just they're having to think about whether that future saving is for a house down payment down the road or something that comes up in the next 3 to 6 months.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think that's very. I think everybody has these moments, unexpected moments, and you know you do tend to plan for longer term things, but it's tricky. So just give us. We've got about 2 minutes before we finish off the show, Rachel. So how can people find out about the book? Where can they find out more information about it? Where can they get a copy of it?
Sure. So it's available on Amazon. It'll be available, theoretically, it launches April 11th, but Amazon's shipping early, which is really fun. You should go to the Diaries website. It's usfinancialdiaries.org. And there's going to be more information there about other events and places that we're speaking. And also, of course, at CFSI's website, CFSinnovation.org, we'll have information about the study and about where we're speaking. We're really trying to get out and talk to people about it as much as possible, because I think that we all see that economic insecurity is top of mind for millions of Americans, and I hope that this book, this research effort, sheds some new ideas on why that is, and also on what you can do about it.
Yeah, well, it's tracking pretty well. It's already in the top 20 for social services and welfare and the bestseller ranking on Amazon. So that's great news for you. Well done.
That's great. Oh, how exciting. I'm glad.
There you go.
Well, thank you for your advice and help about it.
No problem. Any time. So, Rachel Schneider, thanks for joining us on Breaking Banks today.
Thanks so much. It was a delight to be here.
And Mary, thanks for joining us as well from American Banker.
Absolutely.
Now, don't forget to check out FinTech 5, Sam Moll's podcast I mentioned at the top of the hour. And also, Rachel is begging you to go to iTunes. Rachel's our producer, and not Rachel Schneider, Rachel Morrissey. She's begging you to go to iTunes and leave us a good review. Please subscribe when you can to the show on Google Play. We're on SoundCloud. We're on iTunes. Or just go to breakingbanks.com to check out more information about today's guests and our previous episodes. But above all, have a great week, what's left of it. And if I don't speak to you before, then have a great weekend. You've been listening to Breaking Banks. I'm Brett King. See you next week.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.